1171.
They had so many different tools that in other states and other places they never had, like the ability to be able to spy on people, what we would call ghetto birds, right? You know, where you have the helicopters going over. Other law enforcement agencies in other places don't have these things, right? But here in Los Angeles, they do.
If you do not have a validated tap card, you may be subject to penalties.
It's not Compton, what's up, punk? It's South Central, a crime wave of gangster made criminals.
South Central Los Angeles. In mainstream media and in the minds of those who don't work or live here, is often branded by the violent and chaotic flashpoints in its history.
South Central Rooted will demonstrate that these events were culminations of the generations of institutional neglect and exploitation that precedes them. Although some of the conditions changed, this legacy still affects South LA residents in all aspects of their daily lives, from housing and employment to transportation, policing, and the environment.
This broadcast is based on the report by the same name that was developed with the input of over 30 South LA community-based organizations and institutions, 125 resident leaders, and is part of the South LA Building Healthy Communities Collaborative. This report explores four intersecting root causes or drivers of disparity in South LA. In this episode, we will highlight the driver of disparity number three, policing, suppression, deportation, and mass incarceration.
This driver demonstrates the pervasiveness of police presence in South LA, in our neighborhoods, on public transit, in schools, and on the streets, and what it means to surveil, segregate, and push out predominantly youth of color and other vulnerable populations from our communities. South LA is at a crucial moment in reimagining policing in our community. The recent uprisings in honor of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and many other police-related deaths has brought about this conversation of defunding the police. This movement is at the forefront of consciousness and conversation across the U.S. However, South LA residents have a long history of engaging and resisting heavy police presence as part of a broader effort to build a safer environment.
Defund the police is not a new idea. Police reform, resistance, and rebellion go back as far as the very idea of law enforcement and its racist roots in America. Mary Lee, anti-racism systems change consultant, explains.
Broken systems. These are systems that are rigged. They're fixed. They're supposed to work the way they're working. And you can look all the way back into all kinds of places all over the country in different eras to see how violent and oppressive and genocidal those forces were. So for Black people, and that's only one category of people that have been oppressed by policing, but when you take it up through first Reconstruction and then the Jim Crow era, that's how you forced these societal barriers, these racial barriers through what came to become a modern policing.
David Turner, program manager of Brothers Sun Cells Coalition, continues.
Again, to Mary Lee's point earlier, when we started talking about the history and the transition from post-civil rights until the 90s, right, one of the things that we saw, not only the taking away of jobs, right, was also the systemic divestment from all other resources. As California became increasingly more brown, the education budget also began to decrease systemically. In this particular state, we went from one of the top 10 in education spending down to the bottom 10, right? And that's because the majority of young people who are going to California schools are no longer white. As we're talking about policing, one, it has been about control. And two, as we have these broader conversations about race and about racism, we have to understand that policing is just the one most visible sort of avenue that then opens the door for all of these broader conversations about how communities of color, Black communities in this particular case, but communities of color in general, right, have been systemically divested from.
Even though Los Angeles seemed very far away from the South, seemed like it wasn't a place where those strict racial laws of the Black codes and things like that were in existence and enforced. It's really not true. Los Angeles has a history of being extraordinarily separated and racially segregated, and that type of segregation was enforced by police.
Even in this moment of crisis, it is essential to consider the history of policing, suppression, deportation, and mass incarceration to have a full understanding of its role in community health.
Policing, suppression, deportation, and mass incarceration are deeply connected with community health disparities. In June of this year, the American Public Health Association has called out systemic racism and police violence, both of which disproportionately affect communities of color and other marginalized communities, as public health crises.
Policing and suppression affect health in at least three different spheres of life.
First, incarceration. The experience of incarceration takes a toll on the physical and mental health. It exacerbates pre-existing chronic conditions and often denies access to adequate health care, which has been the subject of numerous class action lawsuits against the California State Department of Corrections and LA County Sheriff's Department.
Second, community health. Research has also shown that aggressive policing and pervasive surveillance creates a stressful atmosphere in a neighborhood, which can lead to psychological distress, feelings of anxiety and worthlessness, and other mental health problems for residents, as well as increased risk of diabetes and high blood pressure. This is especially true for young men of color and immigrants who are often targets of over-policing.
Third, and most important, is life course barriers. Finally, a criminal record itself can be a major barrier to future employment, access to public health benefits, and even voting, which carries tremendous human costs over an individual's or a community's life course, particularly for young people of color whose lives are just beginning.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do.
Young people living in South LA today are confronted with multiple forms of pervasive surveillance that follows them from the moment they walk out of the house, on their way to school, and up until the moment they return home. Community members have witnessed firsthand some of the most brutal public killings of civilians in the hands of the police. 25-year-old Ezell Ford Jr. was fatally shot by police officers in 2014, which resulted in a $1.5 million settlement to the family. It was just one of the highest profiles of deadly officer-involved shootings in the history of the Los Angeles Police Department, but by no means the only one.
These tragic events are just one of the consequences from police presence being felt. Almost everyone who lives in South LA is put under this intense and pervasive surveillance by law enforcement. It might not always lead to death, but it still has a lot of serious repercussions for residents who are constantly living in the state of stress and anxiety, especially young people.
Turn around. Put your hands behind your back. You're being detained. You're being detained right now.
In affluent communities, residents feel safe and protected in the presence of law enforcement. But here in low-income Black and brown communities, residents feel targeted by the police. The excessive presence of the officers is not only in their neighborhood streets, but also on the metro, which provides public transportation that many young people rely on to get from one place to the next.
My main duties would be fare compliance. We're basically checking people for fare, make sure they have the correct amount of fare, as well as making sure everybody taps their card when they get onto the train. We usually do a joint briefing with LAPD.
Still, it's in schools where young people often experience the most punishing environments, behaviors that would net a referral to a counselor or principal's office in South LA could lead to the entry point of a pipeline to prison. Thanks to the efforts of local parent and student activists, this punitive culture in schools is slowly changing through policies that best protect youth in South Los Angeles.
You'd think schools were a refuge for many of these students from the outside communities that might be wrecked by violence, especially when you consider how many hours a young person spends on school grounds. But the Los Angeles Unified School District has invested a lot of resources on school police, often at the expense of services that actually support the students' well-being and academic performance.
And we're talking about heavy presence of school police as early as middle school and up.
There's been a big rise in police stationed at schools. There are 44,000 around the country. It's led to concerns over their role and whether teenage behavior is sometimes being inappropriately criminalized.
Up until 2016, LAUSD was inheriting a large stock of military-grade weapons from the U.S. Department of Defense through a program known as 1033. This program has given more than $5 billion worth of surplus military equipment and arms to local law enforcement and school police forces since the 1990s.
Teachers, deans, and other school personnel will often refer students to the school police or the probation department instead of handling the behavioral issues through more restorative programs. And we're talking about behavioral issues that would usually earn the students a trip to the counselor or a stern warning in a suburban school. But in inner cities like South LA, these students were shuffled into the juvenile justice system. It's what some activists have called the school-to-prison pipeline.
In LAUSD, there used to be this category called willful defiance that teachers would often use to kick students out of class. This often led to suspensions or involvement with school police, but the idea of willful defiance was really vague and subjective, and students of color were more likely to be cited than their white peers were. In fact, in 2013, Black students in LA Unified were 9 times more likely to be suspended because of this than white students. To explain what it took to get rid of willful defiance, we invited David Turner of the Brother Sun Selves Coalition.
My name is David Turner. I am the current manager of the Brother Sun Selves Coalition. We're a coalition of 9 community-based organizations doing organizing and advocacy work with boys and young men of color across LA County and the state of California. I am also a 6-year PhD candidate at UC Berkeley, and I am an adjunct lecturer in the Department of Africana Studies at California State University, Dominguez Hills.
How is working with these young men helping to eradicate these systems that are created and that people don't address that exist?
I'll give you an example of the Free Our Dreams conference, which is now called the Youth Power Summit. At that conference, one of the things that they had worked on was an assembly bill to create more strict rules for law enforcement so that way they're not out here just killing people in the first 10 seconds of interacting with them. Same thing that happened to Stephen Clark, or the same thing that happened to their brother that I was out there in Torrance, right? One of the things that these young people did was help to change the narrative to say, look, it's not just those cases that are popularized in the media. These things are happening all the time. And it's not just about them killing us. It's about the conditions and the climate that terrorize our communities. And it's because they have this power to use this type of force unchecked that creates the situation for us. So we need to change that. We need to change the ways in which law enforcement interacts with our communities. And this starts by the ways in which they're able to engage in violence in our communities, right? In 2018, it was Assembly Bill 931 at that time. What passed was Assembly Bill 392. So they were able to help shape the narrative. You know, now California has one of the toughest use of force policies for law enforcement in the country because of the work that these young people, that communities of color have done to push back against the ways law enforcement interact with us.
So you talked about systems. Can you dissect that for folks who may not understand what systems are? And then can you also talk about the importance of young people and particularly young men shaping the narrative around changing those systems?
So the Brothers on Sales Coalition, one of the things that we did was we wanted to help to reshape our priorities, right? And we wanted our priorities to be rooted in the experiences and needs of our young people and community. So we surveyed over 3,000 people across LA County to figure out what some of their needs were, 3,700 total. With this survey, we found a lot of different things. One of the things that we found was that we had 128 different cases where young people had said that they had been physically harmed by law enforcement. Of this 128 different cases, nearly 40% of those cases, those young people had never been arrested before. So these are people who are being impacted by law enforcement, who are being hurt by law enforcement, who quite frankly didn't do anything. When we talk about systems and we talk about systems change, what policies and what laws are giving these officers the ability to be able to do that to community members? In what ways can that change? When we talk about the idea of systems, oftentimes when people think about racism, they think about feelings and they think about attitudes. They think about the KKK. They might think about, you know, to make America great again, right? I mean, more recently in, you know, this last 4 years, you know, the Trump era, the struggle. But when people think about racism, they think about that. Like, they're not oftentimes thinking about the ways public policy has manifested racism over time or how public policy has allowed racism to happen. Let's say, for example, what's happening in schools, right? In some schools, they didn't have protections around something called willful defiant school suspension, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when you're willfully defiant, right, or what was defined as willful defiance or what some people would call defiance and disruption is, let's say, for example, a kid got a really bad haircut, right? You know, and they didn't want to take off their hoodie because they're like, look, I don't want people to see my hair because then they're going to laugh, mm-hmm. right? So if the teacher says, take off your hoodie, the student says no. Teacher says, take off your hoodie, the student says no, then that student can be then sent out of class and suspended for that. So you can lose class time essentially for anything. It's a catch-all term for if you defy a teacher's orders, it might not even be a real rule. But if you defy a teacher's orders, then at that point you could be suspended for it. We ended that in the state of California this past year for grades K through 8 in LAUSD through the School Climate Bill of Rights. We ended that in 2013 for grades K through 12. So again, when we talk about systems, we got to think if kids are being defiant, which kids are the ones that are being suspended? And which kids are the ones that they're saying are defiant? And more times than not, it was kids of color, specifically boys of color, and in particular black boys, who were being suspended for things that people would say they're defiant for.
I recently saw in the news that police have been using the gang cards that they were using like in the early 90s to identify people as gang members in their database when they necessarily may not be gang members, but they will identify them as gang members and use these cards to create this database of quote-unquote gang members. And I heard that now that they've been using them in high schools as well with their security or with the school police or with the LAPD or whatever is their policing agent at each school. Do you know about this? Do you have any views on it?
I'll start off with something that my grandpa used to say. You know, it ain't nothing new under the sun. This goes back a very long time. The first gang database at LAPD used was a collaboration between LAUSD and LAPD back in 1973.
Oh, wow.
Right? It's called the Alpha File. That was the first gang database that they used, and they piloted it at Crenshaw High School.
Really?
That was the first gang database, right? That's a good book. I can think of the subtitle, right? Or the title of the book is Policing Los Angeles, The Rise of the LAPD. Guy named Max Faulkner Cantor, I believe his name is. And in it, he talks about the ways in which in a liberal city, right, you know, with the air quotes, right, in a liberal city like Los Angeles, how you get police who have so much power. In the South, you have such overt racism, right, you know, from law enforcement. Out here in Los Angeles, you still have that overt racism, but they had so many different tools that in other states and other places they never had, like the ability to be able to spy on people, the ability to have these databases, right, like what we would call ghetto birds, right, you know, where you have the helicopters going over. Other law enforcement agencies in other places don't have these things, right, but here in Los Angeles they do. Here in Los Angeles, this is what Kelly Lytle Hernandez would call the carceral capital of the world. We lock up more people than any other place, right, on the planet here. And we have to remember that the people who are the ones doing the locking up are law enforcement. So we can't be the carceral capital of the world without having the tools in which to make that a reality, right? Which is, you know, school police officers having tanks and, you know, military weapons or, you know, having helicopters flying over or having gang databases, right? Even before computers were able to run that way. So again, with that being said, There's nothing new under the sun. And when we see something like what happened recently with LAPD having these gang databases, or the Metro Division specifically, we're seeing another iteration of how racism continues to evolve.
How do you feel like the Willful Defiance label contributed to the school-to-prison pipeline?
There's a direct relationship between the ways in which young people are suspended and the young people who are arrested. When we're talking about the relationship between arrests and suspensions, oftentimes suspensions are some of the first points that we have where young people are starting to be criminalized. They become pushed out of school. And when young people are pushed out of school, right, whether it's for defiance or even if it's for something that's not defiance, right, like fighting, for example. Let's say they get into a fight. Instead of actually getting to the root cause of it and helping the young people deal with the situation, right, what ends up happening is, you know, young people are pushed out of school. They're pushed out of school. Now there's no more structured time. And what the research tells us is when young people have a significant amount of structured time, especially among caring adults, right, they're bound to have a lot higher achievement in a number of areas, right? Whether it's college access, whether it's access to employment, whether it is responsiveness to certain things, whether it's the ability to handle their own priorities. They have access to those things when they're in school, when they have structured time. Right. When that doesn't happen, there's more research to suggest that there's other things that go on, right? With that being said, that leads to the what we call the school-to-prison pipeline. Or what some researchers would call the school-to-prison nexus. Because to say it's a pipeline would mean that schools were just funneling kids into prisons and that schools didn't operate some ways as jails already.
Oppressive school systems have been proven to introduce negative lifelong implications for children. However, schools can also be suppressive environments that disempower parents from active involvement, which reinforces the risk to children and further entrenches the cycle of health disparities in the broader community.
My name is Maisie Chin. I have been the co-founder and executive director of CADRE, Community Asset Development Redefining Education. The journey really started in 1991, but CADRE's really officially been around since 2001.
Could you give us some details on what you all do at CADRE?
So CADRE is a center for parent organizing, but really in a transformative way. So we do our best to create a setting where parents can really think about their own stories. So yes, it's about their children, but we're one of the places where we want them to think about themselves and their journey, realizing that their story has a lot to do with how they move through the world, and instead of only focusing on their kids. So our work has always been about hearing from parents, and doing so figure out what are the issues that we actually have to address that would create the conditions for them to truly have power in the community and in the schools.
Sounds like y'all are a safe space for parents.
We call it parent organizing, but it ends up being a lot of storytelling. It ends up being more of a healing space, and we do leadership development, political development, but the goal is really for them to practice being in solidarity with other parents. So the parent who co-founded CADRE with me, Rosalinda Hill, may she rest in peace, she was raising five kids in South Central at the time, and she was that parent on the payroll at an elementary school that several of her children went through. She was on campus every day. She had gone to every single conference or training offered. And so she really was already in that world of being not just an involved parent, but even beyond, I think, the typical. But it didn't stop her second grade son at the time from being locked in a closet for school discipline. She was on campus every day. School staff knew who she was and still didn't go down the hall or speak to her or feel that they had to do anything different. Like there was no leverage, essentially, for the fact that she was a known quantity on campus. Most parents, they want their involvement to make conditions better for their children in terms of how they were seen and treated, but very few vehicles for being involved in education or at a school. They can't even speak on those things. And so we had to really build a different model.
Did you find that the challenge or the problem in the schools were coming from an inherently racist system or a culturally incompetent administration?
I would say it's definitely both. But I would add another layer to it all, which is that, and this is a socially accepted thing, is to blame and shame parents. You know, it's like, we're going to educate the kids despite their parents, right? Mm. Or let's hope their parents, you know, aren't terrible.
Right.
It's
right.
a very low bar. And so I think the hardest thing that was evident at the beginning of our journey was that parents would also have to acknowledge that as much as they had learned their rights or started to become and feel empowered, they had to acknowledge that there was still racist treatment of them. Most of our Friday night living room conversations were about racism.
Does Cadre focus on a particular area?
So when parents go to schools and they hear from school staff, you know, disparaging comments by other parents, like certain parents not being involved, and it's usually racialized, then that also plays out in the community and plays out in parents' willingness to work together and be organized. We have really done a lot of work to try to interrupt all of that. And when we did our participatory action research and said, hey, guess what? Lots of parents across the board feel the schools are racist and don't treat you well, don't respect your culture, and don't take your input seriously. Analyzing, critiquing the relationship period between parents and schools in South LA became the basis for trying to build connection and unity across the board. Eventually, that research and those findings led to us creating what we're called standards of dignity and respect for parents. And one of those standards was allowing parents to monitor and critique and evaluate school practices and programs, because that's not typically what schools want from parents. And so we then saw that school discipline and push out, especially when kids got sent home and suspended, that was where they seemed to have the least amount of power and the least amount of recourse. So we sort of zeroed in on monitoring school discipline.
What steps did you take to work with the parents to create a narrative that then would engage other families in your movement? And then how does that translate to actual change in a district like LA Unified?
So one of the most common things that parents would share when they would get together at our house meetings was really of how you felt the minute you walked into campus or you made a phone call. And to this day, people are still striving to achieve some kind of welcoming environment at school for parents. I mean, it's still an issue. But certainly back then, most of the parent empowerment at the time was really about the parents themselves empowering themselves and learning, okay, well, if this is how it is, you have to learn your rights, you have to, you know the chain of command, you know, drop names, et cetera, et cetera. This is a systemic issue. This is not just a cool principal over here that's cool with parents, and then down the street is another school where it's hostile to parents. This should be everywhere. Regardless, it shouldn't be depending on the personality, if you will, of the school staff. And so what we did is we try to use that as the common experience to raise parents' consciousness. Why is it not welcoming? So to go beyond, like I said, the individual principal, because that's usually what the narrative was. Oh, I like my school. My principal is really nice. They greet us, da-da-da. Down the street, it's like, oh, they don't talk to anybody. They yell at us. You know, they don't help us. We had to get parents out of seeing that as just the individual luck of the draw and that it was a systemic issue and that there's actually a set of structural barriers and consistent practices that are more common than not that are going to happen to certain parents in certain types of communities and is part and parcel of why your children's quality of education is what it is.
Both Macy and David pinpoint systemic structural barriers as the recent schools in South Central have negative impacts on the communities they are meant to serve, the children and the parents. Macy, for example, provides insight into how she and her team at Cadre work with the parents to understand the wider view of the problem to come up with better solutions.
So we did our best to link it to a much bigger picture instead of making it just like, let me teach you how to talk to the school, you know, let me teach you how to flex so that they wouldn't treat you this way. I mean, yes, we did that too, but that wasn't the end goal. I mean, that was sort of the mini step so that folks could get their issues better addressed. But what we were really doing more of is raising the consciousness that this was a much bigger issue. It's a structural one. It's one, a question of power. And it's the question of organizing to change that. We train parents on their rights, try to do a little bit of the history of education. You know what I mean? That it was always inherently unfair. It's not just your child or the one thing that happened, you know, to your child. It's just not this school or this principal. Shoot, it's not even just South Central schools. So even though we were, you know, exposing parents to their rights, there was still this other side where parents were still feeling like failures or feeling like, you know, they were being cut off at the knees, they couldn't defend their kids. And so there had to be a place to put all that anger and that frustration. It had to be a place where you made sense of why it was so infuriating. So it's one thing to hear that, okay, it's a big issue. It's another thing to hear then other parents just like you living down the street or having the same feelings of disempowerment and marginalization, exclusion, just completely being ignored. The child advocates inside LA Unified at the time wanted to push for something that was child-centered, whole child, development-oriented, positive, and focused on prevention as much as control and intervention. And the other half, most of the school board wanted like three strikes, you're out. And so we were walking into the middle of that political debate. And I would just say that when we studied the policy, we decided to throw our weight behind school-wide positive behavior support because it had data. It had recourse, or what we call handles, for parents to push back. It meant that when teachers or school staff administrators said something really crazy and dehumanizing to young people, we could actually question, was this positive behavior support? So when they said racist things and, you know, you're not going to be nothing and I can, you know, I get paid no matter what, you keep doing whatever you're going to do, we could start questioning the climate, the attitude, the perceptions. And that was big for starting this movement. So yes, school-wide positive behavior support is not the most radical thing. It's actually very basic, but it is what the schools in the more affluent communities have automatically. So when we were starting to really throw our weight behind policy change and leveraging all these stories we had collected into saying there's a whole new type of practice needed, what was happening in other parts of the country, also some small mom-and-pop grassroots parent groups were also raising the issue in places like Mississippi and Denver. There was starting to be some academic research about if this is good for young people, and, you know, if this is good for children. Is this what schools should be doing, is treating them like prisoners? And certainly, you know, one of the other choices we had to make, we also sort of picked our battle to focus on this bottom that was falling out. And a lot of times these were the families that were the most disposable, even to education people, you know, even to education organizers in some cases. And so we sort of chose to sit in a lane that was not really even respected, even within the space of fighting for a better education. There was no funding for this work. There was no sort of political cachet to this work. We were trying to legislate treatment. I mean, how do you know when you win that? You know, like it hadn't matured yet into a viable issue. You know, in our humble opinion at Cadre, that the remaining work that has to be done is really implementation, which is what we've been focused on for many, many years now, ever since we got our first policy victory. We've been training parents to be at these tables and ask these difficult questions. And so I would humbly say that both high school students and parents need to be able to be designing their school climates, be designing what their schools look like, but with the intention to prevent push out and mistreatment.
The community leaders we heard from today have demonstrated that South LA residents continue to push against unjust and racist policing practices and philosophies. Brother Sun Selves advocated for Assembly Bill 392, also known as the Police Use of Force Bill.
Okay, if you haven't heard of a major bill to change the rules around police use of force in California, just made a big step forward. It's called AB 392, and today it passed its first committee in the Assembly.
This campaign won and redefined the circumstances under which the use of lethal force by a police officer is considered justifiable.
How can a dead man speak? They don't shoot to heart or say, okay, we're going to shoot you in the leg and you can live to see another day. They shoot to kill. So the person that they quote unquote can see the different perspective will be people like myself advocating for a dead person, a dead mind.
And this advocacy work is led by the communities most impacted by the criminal justice system, the youth in South Los Angeles. For example, David also highlighted the Youth Power Summit in which young people are leading policy changes.
I'm concerned that police are funded and replacing our nurses, our counselors, our psychologists, our social workers, and we know that student needs are not being met.
To interrupt the mistreatment of parents and students in schools, Cadre has advocated for school-wide positive behavior support. Parents have led this work with participatory action research. However, the fight for equitable and safe policies continues.
Parents in South LA did not need to be told how to raise their children or how to live in their community. They need to be centered and organized to give us the answers and how to build better communities.
South LA BHC partners are currently working to ensure community safety on a number of fronts. The Labor Community Strategy Center's Fight for the Soul of the Cities project led the effort to de-weaponize the Los Angeles School Police Department, LASPD.
Their advocacy resulted in the LASPD withdrawal from the Department of Defense 1033 program, also known as the Excess Military Equipment Program. And they returned all weapons, including grenade launchers, M16s, and even a tank. In collaboration with the South LA BHC partners, this campaign has picked up steam, and they continue to work towards implementing the multifaceted urban reconstruction campaign to transform the conditions of poverty perpetuated by the criminal justice system. Community leaders advocated for the Los Angeles Fair Chance Initiative for Hiring, also known as Ban the Box.
This ordinance prohibits employers from inquiring about criminal histories until a conditional job offer has been made. This important campaign win helps remove job barriers for South LA residents and others impacted by the criminal justice system.
St. John's Well Child and Family Center, a health clinic and a leader in tackling health disparities, is one of the largest healthcare providers for undocumented immigrants in the nation and has become a target for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, activity.
To protect their patients from ICE raids, St. John's developed a strategy that includes training staff to organize and educate patients on their rights and utilizing waiting rooms as a safe training space. This is an example of how community and sectoral collaboration is key in combating racist policies. And these are just a few examples of the work being done in South LA and greater Los Angeles region to transform approaches to policing and public safety.
South LA community members are leaders in the effort to reimagine and redefine law enforcement policy and transform our criminal justice system.
These efforts are informed by South LA's extensive history of grassroots movements rising up against overwhelming police presence.
Even now, this moment's energetic movement to defund the police draws from the many long-standing efforts to combat police brutality and invest in community safety.
There are a number of avenues residents of South LA can get involved, and we encourage you to support and learn more about local efforts.
This podcast is made possible by the generous investments of the California Endowment. The content is taken from the South LA Rooted Report, which is written by Laura Murata and Eric Watt in collaboration with Special Service for Groups Incorporated.
The show is produced at the Hood Digest DigiLab. It's narrated by Marlo J. and Elmer Roldan. The theme music features original content from South Central Cartel's South Central Madness and original music produced by Rico Pavon. The podcast is produced by Daniel Castillo and Brian Aguilar. Our assistant producer is Nelly Arciniega.
Subscribe, share, comment, and like the South LA Rooted podcast on all platforms.